Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
Now, I got a question for you. What is it that our emotions can take hold of and very often not with the greatest of outcomes? What is it that everyone has a relationship with, and actually everyone can say they have a love-hate relationship with it? You don't know? How about money? I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Carrie Carbonaro. Carrie is the author of The Money Queen's Guide for Women who Want to Build Wealth and Banish Fear. Carrie's website is moneyqueenguide.com, and I'd like to say hello to Carrie. Carrie, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Carrie, your book certainly struck a chord because you make the point early on that the way in which we think about money, spend it, lose it, play with it, whatever we do, is very much has an emotional underpinning to that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, money is very important to all of us because we can't really live without it. So back to your love-hate relationship. So people want to love it, but then they feel guilty if they love it, and then they want to hate it because it drives them crazy because they don't know what they're doing with it. So it's very emotional. Now, then you throw in the fact that you subconsciously make decisions surrounding money without even knowing what you're doing when you're doing it, and then that is going to determine positive or negative decisions within your life without you even realizing what you're doing. So, for example, if you are going through a divorce, and which is a very emotional time in your life,
exactly.
Even if it's a positive divorce, or if, you know, there are some of those, but unfortunately, most of them are not, the majority are not. So let's just say we're going through a divorce, and positive or negative, you're going through a divorce. Very emotionally charged. You're going to make decisions in your life surrounding money, which may or may not be the best decision because it's an emotional decision because your emotions are running high. Now, that's a great time in your life where you need to help. You might need guidance from somebody. Let me give you one other example of, you know, making a bad emotional decision.
Okay.
So, for example, let's say, you know, the market is going down or going up and going down and going up and going down, like kind of how it is right now. It's a volatile market right now. And you look at your bank accounts or, your 401ks or your retirement accounts, and you see, okay, I lost, you know, 20% in a month, and I'm freaking out, and the market's going to zero, and I can't afford to lose this money. This is my retirement. I'm out. I can't sleep at night. I need to go to cash. And that is another very poor emotional decision around money made because of your emotions.
All right, so there are lots of ways and lots of people who will find themselves, if they're not careful about their emotional connection to money, can actually make some really harmful decisions for themselves and only become aware of it after the fact versus before the fact, which is when they can actually make a change in what they're doing.
Yeah.
Now, Carrie, because
yeah.
of your credentials, you have been a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, USA Today, Bloomberg. I mean, you've been all over the place. You've been on the Today Show, CBS, Fox News, ABC. Clearly, you are an expert. You grew up with a dad who was a banker and a mom who
yeah.
was a CPA. So that would tell us that you knew everything there was to know about money. And yet you say that even you had a pretty challenging financial whirlwind going about you when you experienced what you call a painful and financially damaging divorce. What happened?
Correct. So It's funny because
Carrie, let me interrupt you for a second. I keep hearing you hit one of the keys on the cell phone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I've heard it three times now. So I'm just going to ask you to be mindful of that, and I'm going to ask you the question again.
Sure.
Okay.
Does that sound better, by the way? I just changed something. Does that make a difference?
Actually, you sound a little bit further away.
Okay. Well, I had the phone up to my ear, and so, all right, let me take it back. All right, so now it's back. Now it's back in my ear.
Okay, that sounds better.
Okay.
All right, so let's try that.
Just touch
another button. Okay. All right, and that way you won't touch the buttons because it's in headpiece is in your ear?
No, I don't have the headpiece on. I just have the phone up to my ear.
Okay. All right. Let's keep our fingers crossed and off the phone. Let me ask you the question again. Okay?
Sure.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, Carrie, given all of the background that you have had with money and all of the expertise that you have with money, even as we speak, it would make sense to assume that your life with money has always been fabulous. I mean, you grew up with a mother and a father who were both financially aware. And yet, you say that even after you had built a successful business, you got married, you experienced a painful and financially damaging divorce. How did that happen?
So it's interesting. That's one of the main reasons that made me say I have to write a book, because I really need to share this story. And you're right. I knew everything about money. Everything. There was nothing that I didn't know on book smart. And I experienced it my entire life. I did all the right moves with money until I didn't. Or until I met a man who wanted to financially devastate me, and I started to go through a terrible, painful divorce. And while I was going through this terrible, painful divorce, my emotions were completely controlling me. And I was trying to make the right decisions, but it was almost too late because I was already in a downward spiral happening all around me. So I was just trying to keep my head above water, and for the first time in my life I was bleeding cash, and I couldn't even make money fast enough. I had to use my emergency fund to get through the difficult times. Luckily I had it because I again followed my own advice and had all this money set aside waiting for me for my emergency. And my emergency was this divorce that I never planned on, that I never expected, that I never knew anything that was going to happen like this ever in my wildest dreams. So for this extreme example to happen to me, somebody who knows what they're doing, I know how many other people have been in this situation. And I want to keep people out of this situation, which is why I wrote this book.
What kinds of things were going on in your marriage financially? Because as you described your husband on paper, he certainly sounded like he would have it all together financially as well.
Oh, he definitely had it all together financially. There was no question about that. The issue was that it was financial infidelity. So what that means is one spouse hiding things from the other spouse or not being truthful and honest, no full disclosure. And I didn't even really know that this was happening. So, I mean, I guess that's the other part, is that I was, you know, trusting and not necessarily naive. I didn't think of myself as naive, but in a couple of cases I was, because so he happened to be an attorney and a CPA. And when he told me that he had to be on both the deeds of both the houses without being on the mortgage, I believed him because he told me that that was the law. And I said, okay, why would my spouse lie to me? It turns out that's actually not the case. When you're responsible, so let me explain that in another term. So I was responsible for the mortgage of both houses, but he was on the deeds with me in both houses, which means when the divorce started, He was able to live in the houses. He didn't have to pay for any of the houses ever. And he wouldn't let me sell or rent or do anything with the houses because he was on the deed. However, I was on the financial hook.
Interesting. So he got you pretty good, or bad, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it. That's just a simple one that I thought of. I write about it in the story. I tell my story because I really think my story is incredibly powerful, because I really believe that if it can happen to me, it can happen to anyone. So every woman should take steps to protect themselves financially and be financially literate and responsible for themselves.
Now, you also tell the story about the separation agreement. And, I mean, it's a pretty chilling story as you described it. It was drafted by your husband. He's an attorney. It was 100 pages long.
Correct.
And talk about what you came home to the day that you were presented with this 100-page document.
Correct. So I got a call. This is interesting. I got a call from his paralegal, and she said to me, "Are you coming to the house?" Now, we had already decided that we were going to separate, and pretty much that's about it. That was about what we did. And then she said, "Are you coming home?" And I said, "Yes, why?" And she said, "Well, we have 6 people here ready to notarize and witness your signature." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "For the marital separation agreement." And I said, "What marital separation agreement?" And she goes, "It's everything you already agreed to." I hadn't agreed to anything.
Interesting.
I didn't know what she was talking about. So I didn't really know what to do. And I felt like between a rock and a hard place at that moment in time. It was probably the worst decision I ever did, was to go home to that house. Because I thought to myself, well, A, how bad can it be? B, I've got all these people calling me, waiting for me. C, where am I going to go? And D, all my my stuff is in the house. My client information is in the house. My computer is in the house. Like, what do I do? Just walk away from everything without having a chance to, you know, never go back again? Like, it was so incredibly overwhelming to me at the time. So I went back, even though I actually did call my therapist and he told me not to go. And I couldn't not go because I just didn't know what else to do. I didn't feel like I had a support system with me down in Florida at that moment in time.
Okay.
And I honestly didn't know what to do. So I walk in and to an ambush with all these people ready to sign my signature. And I go into a room with my ex-husband, who pretty much says, "Sign this or else, and some other words that I can't say on this radio."
I appreciate that.
Very, very, very threatening, let's just put it that way. And he said, "If you don't sign this, it will be so much worse for you. You have no idea what I have in store for you." So I said, "Can I read it?" And he said, "No." He said, "You can look at the part where you're splitting the business, my business." Now, and I'm assuming that he's splitting his businesses, but again, nothing was talked about. And I said, "Okay, we're splitting my business." Meanwhile, in the back of my mind, I already knew I'm just going to shut my business down and move my clients to another location because that's what my attorneys told me to do.
Okay.
So I already knew that one little part, which is the only part of the marital separation agreement, was going to be null and void because I was already doing what my attorney told me to do. So I said, "Okay, I'll sign it," because I already knew that one little part was going to be taken care of. Well, it turns out in the other, 90-something pages, there was crazy things in there, which I never got to see till after I signed it, like till weeks after I signed it. And then it took about a year to get it thrown out of the court.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it was so egregious.
And I would think that it had to have been pretty egregious for the courts to throw it out.
Yes.
And it's interesting, you said you called your therapist, but you didn't call your attorney.
No. I know. How do you like that? Well, my attorney would have told me not to sign it. But I, again, was not thinking clearly. I mean, that's when emotions take over and, you know, fight or flight, and everything gets cloudy and fuzzy, and you know, you're definitely not thinking with a good head on your shoulders when that kind of emotion takes over.
And certainly that is a stunning example of what can happen. And again, we're both saying that it's stunning because on paper, you of all people would never be in that situation. And so what it reminds the listener of is that everybody, anybody can be in the kind of situation, particularly when it comes to finances, where your emotions kind of get the best of you and you're not really paying attention and taking care of yourself in a way that you should.
Right. And what's interesting is at the time, and I've gone back to that day, you know, with my therapist in my life, in my memory, and I literally, in my head, like disassociated and almost like blacked out and pretended this was not even happening. Like I was almost like an out of body experience. Like I wasn't there. I wasn't signing it. I just wanted to get it over with. I wanted to get all these people out. I wanted to, you know, so in my head, it was just not happening. Like it was happening, but it wasn't happening. It's a crazy thing to have to experience, but I can learn and teach from that experience.
And you know, the other thing that it points out is that trauma really can show up in lots of different ways. You know, so many times we hear the word trauma sort of bandied about today, and I think most people assume that they know what trauma is, but they know what it is based on what would be traumatizing to them, and that doesn't necessarily replicate every single example of trauma. And for you, you were in your home, but it was no longer your home in that moment. You'd sort of been invaded. You were unsafe. There was someone who had power over you. From what you're describing, he was threatening your life. And whether it was your emotional life or your financial life, he was certainly threatening the life that you knew. And so the fact that you would, in a state of extreme stress, dissociate from the situation makes complete sense. And again, I think that many people need to recognize how much sense it makes that when you are under extreme stress, dissociation happens. Not to everybody, not all the time, but to many people much of the time.
Yes, and it's interesting because I've said in my head, it was as if he had a gun to my head and told me to sign.
And really, that's what it kind of sounds like.
Yes, and that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
I mean, with or without the gun, that's what it was to me. It was my life depended on me signing this agreement. So, and it's so funny because I actually said, he did actually threaten my life also, but in a terrible type of way of the type of person that he is. The last thing he ever said to me without attorneys present were, if you get attorneys involved, I will have you commit suicide.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. So this is what I went through for, you know, X amount of years of my life. So, and now I'm on the other side, and now I just want to help as many women as I can, or people, or anybody. And really my gift is the finance. So now I go back to the finance and I use the emotions in the finance because it's all interrelated.
It absolutely is. Carrie Carbonaro, author of The Money Queen's Guide for Women Who Want to Build Wealth and Banish Fear. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Carrie, I'm going to ask you to tell us about that time that you talked to your therapist, and your therapist asked you a question, and you had no clue as to how to answer it. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment, so you sit tight. Carrie, just to put this in, I think in even more in perspective for the listener, in your book, The Money Queen's Guide, you quote some statistics which I'd like to share. 42%,
oh, sure.
42% of all women lack financial security. 49% of women fear losing all of their money and becoming homeless. What's so fascinating about that is that that's almost half the female population are afraid yeah. of losing all their money and becoming homeless. And then you quote a statistic from 2004 in which you indicate that the median income for retired women was $12,080 compared to men, which was $21,000. That was in 2004. Yeah. Has it changed? Has it gotten more equitable? Is it the same?
No, it's the same. I mean, it's gone up because of, you know, inflation, but no, it's still that much of a gap. That's the gap. With, you know, when you always hear of like the retirement gap or the wage gap, it's all related. And there's, if you want to go into this, there's like five main reasons why that is.
Why is that?
One is women don't negotiate for their salaries.
Okay.
Two is women don't work as long as men because they take off time to be caregivers, either to parents or to kids. Three, this is more on the retirement side, but they live longer, so they need more money, so then they also have that going against them.
Mm-hmm.
Then they don't get aggressive enough on their retirement portfolio, so then they have less money than men. And then I think am I missing one of those? Oh, and five, it's all more on the conservative stuff, is that they don't even know what they need to save.
They don't even know what they need to save, which
right.
that's, you know, pretty common, but pretty scary all at the same time. It's more of that ability, I think, to dissociate, particularly for women when it comes to money. And when you think about money as this whole huge, huge financial complicated thing, it's kind of easy to dissociate from the reality of it in your life.
Yes. And also, I think women also think, somebody's going to take care of this for me.
And that may not be a good thought to have. Not if that's your only thought.
I want to empower women to say, no, you're going to take care of this for you.
Absolutely. Helps you to feel better and more secure when it's really true. Carrie,
yes.
Talk about the time that you went to a therapist. Your therapist asked you what you were feeling, and what did you say? How did you respond?
I said... I don't even understand the question. I am so out of touch with my emotion that I didn't even understand what I was feeling. How crazy is that?
That is, unfortunately, very normal. That's very normal for people walking into a therapist's office to not really, they can tell you how, at least in my experience, you know, folks can tell me how they think. They can tell me what they think, but to really delve into what they're feeling, that's a whole different conversation.
Well, luckily, I can do that now. I can certainly do that today.
Which
I've come a long way.
Which is a very good thing. All right.
Yeah.
Now, you also described yourself at the beginning of your marriage as being open, vulnerable, trusting, which is what one would think that one would want to be as you're walking into, whether it's a marriage or a living together or any kind of loving relationship. You're open, you're vulnerable, you're trusting. And then you threw in another little caveat. You said that also helped you to be the perfect victim. So help me with that one.
So it works if both parties are open and vulnerable. It doesn't work and only one is.
Okay. Very true.
Right?
Very true. Now, you early on in the book, you give a website for folks to take a look at, findyourmoneymind.com. What will they find
yeah.
out at that website?
Sure. So that is my firm, United Capital, and we have, it's a great behavioral finance type of test where you get to see what how your personality is unconsciously driven by your money decisions. So there's three main ones: happiness, commitment, and fear. And some people are a combination of them, and some people are very strong in one, some people are 100% in one. And it's kind of interesting to find out. You may already know that fear drives your decisions, or not, or you may, you know, you, or, and just having the knowledge is the point, so that, you know, next time you decide, you know, can I afford to buy a new car, you know that fear in the back of your head is stopping you, and it may not necessarily be the correct reason, but fear is saying, no, you can't do it, you know, fear is coming in, but it's more of, well, let's look at the numbers, let's take emotion out of it.
So it sounds like, I mean, we're talking specifically about women and all the things that women know to feel empowered in the areas of finance, but it also sounds like so much of what we're saying relates to people, male and female.
Absolutely, it does. You know, it absolutely does. It's interesting because I find in my profession, because I work more with women than men, just because the majority of my clients are women, I just see that women have more strikes against them, and also make more decisions surrounding money with emotions than men. Some men do, but for a majority, more women do it, from my experience.
All right. So
because we're more emotional beings.
So just share this website address again at your company's website.
Sure. It's yourmoneymind.com. Findyourmoneymind.com.
Okay. Findyourmoneymind, all the words are spelled out, .com.
Yeah.
And you say that there are three kind of mindsets that you've discovered that people have: fear, commitment, and happiness. So, I mean,
yes.
Again, that's going to be important for people to sort of understand. If you have a commitment mindset, does that mean you're committed to saving money and to being financially secure?
No, that means your commitment is to help other people.
Oh.
So your decisions are based on your commitment to help family members or your spouse or your kids. And you actually, you're a caregiver. And you potentially forego what's maybe best for you.
Now, there are a lot of folks who assume that parents, particularly mom, will be there financially to support them throughout their lifetimes, through whatever it is that's going on. There are lots of mothers who feel the same way. Is that a good thing or a not good thing, or does it all depend?
Oh, well, I have a strong feeling on this. I believe that children should be financially secure on their own and financially free and financially literate, you know, by the time they graduate from college. That's the way I was brought up. That's the way my stepson was raised, and he's 23 and completely financially independent. Won't even take, like, he doesn't even like when we give him money for Christmas. But we're very blessed and fortunate with that.
I was about to say, I'm thinking about all those 40-year-olds who were taking money from their moms, and happily so.
Well, it's interesting. So, and that's another whole thing when we talk about, like, education and paying for your child's education, which is another story, because I always say this, and people always remember that I say this to them: you cannot finance your retirement, but you can finance your child's education. So, for example, I have a lot of people who are not, you know, who would rather, you know, pay for their kids' college and not fund their retirement.
Right.
And I say, oh, no, 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 no. You have to pay for you have to fund your retirement first.
Fund your retirement first.
Yes.
And I would think,
then back to taking care of, you know, relying on mom,
mm-hmm.
for paying the bills and stuff. So I would say, again, from the way we raised my stepson, we raised him to be financially independent. And it's so funny because we even made him take out student loans, just so that he would have some skin in the game. And we originally thought, you know, small amount, like $5,000 a year. So we had $20,000 when it came out, which is small, you know, in relation to what college costs.
Indeed.
At a private school and et cetera. So when we came out, we thought for graduation that we were going to just pay them off for him. And we thought about it, and we said to him, look, we'll give you an option. We pay off your student loans, or we buy you a car. You choose. Which, what do you think he chose?
I'm going to guess the car.
Exactly. So he took the car. And actually, we wound up spending more money on the car than we did on the student loans. And about 6 months after we bought him the car, and the student loan payment came due, which was a, you know, small amount. But he said to me and his dad, how about paying off those student loans? And we said, we bought you a car. And he said, well, I'm going to sell the car and pay off the student loans. And we said, okay, but then your car payment's going to be higher than your student loan payment. And then we went back and forth with that. And then we decided, okay, we're just going to let him pay off the student loans. So it's going to build his character. And he can afford it because he's making enough money to pay off the... It's like $150 a month.
Okay.
He can afford it.
Okay. You know, it's a very different way of thinking for, I'm sure, many of the folks who were listening. I wonder in your... Oh, by the way, let me interrupt myself. I hear you talking about your stepson and your husband. This is a new husband, yes?
Yes, this is the fabulous husband.
This is the fabulous... Okay, we like fabulous husbands. Okay, good. Just wanted to get that out there.
Finally got it right.
Okay.
I finally got it right.
This is excellent.
Time, but I finally
okay.
got it right.
All right, now, for the... Let's talk about the mother of... she's now a single parent. There's been a divorce. There's been a separate... Something has gone on, and now she is without a partner. And she has a child or children. How much saving can she do? How much planning can she really do if she's got a paycheck that literally takes her almost from week to week?
Yes. You're talking about my sister, actually.
Okay, then.
So, my sister is this example. And she cannot save during the year. What she does do, though, which I'm very proud of her, is when she gets her tax refund, that's her savings.
Okay. So she has found a way to save something.
Yes, because now, she has children, and she gets all that money back from her taxes, from being a single mom.
Now, there are folks who, when they get their tax refund, that's party time. Or it's paying off a bill and party time. Are you recommending that people routinely, when they get a lump sum of cash, put it all into savings, partially into savings? What are you thinking?
Well, I would say a good rule of thumb, I'm a huge saver, so I'm not the norm, but I would say a third, a third, and a third would be nice.
Okay.
So a third you can spend, a third into savings, and a third to pay off debt if you have it.
Okay.
And if you don't have debt, then you could do half savings, half spending.
Okay. The idea that many women have, whether they're in their 20s or beyond, that somehow someone will come along and take care of them, make it right, fix things. That's not an uncommon hope for many women.
No. As a matter of fact, the saying is, a man is not a plan.
Don't make the man your plan.
Yes.
Okay, that's a good saying. I haven't heard that one. But
isn't that a good one?
That's an excellent one. Now, you talked about allowing your child to pay off his student loans as part of building his character, his sense of responsibility and taking ownership for his own actions and behaviors. What about if you're trying to care for elderly parents or disabled children? I would think that'd be a slightly different, or would you still have the same recommendation that the person has to take care of themselves first?
No. In both of those cases, you're responsible. I would be responsible for if I had a disabled child or a parent. No, absolutely, then I would feel responsible for that.
And so in terms of their having savings, would that then be something that you would take on or ask them to take on? How would that actually work financially?
Well, it depends. So, for example, what I tell a lot of my clients is if their parents don't have, like, let's say, long-term care insurance, I actually tell my clients to buy the long-term care insurance for their parents.
Okay.
Because they're going to be responsible anyway. So it would be great. You're allowed to do that. As the child, you're allowed to take out insurance on the parent.
Okay.
For long-term care. Because it's your responsibility, I feel like, anyway. So, you know, then you just have insurance come into play rather than just have all out of your pocket.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's one recommendation that you would routinely make for folks, if they can, to purchase long-term care insurance for their parents.
Yes, or for themselves.
Okay.
Or both.
Or both, actually. That would make sense. And are there any particular considerations if you have an adult child in the house who's disabled?
Oh, that's very complicated. I would say you need a special needs trust for that child, which means you need to go to an attorney and set up, you know, provisions for that child. And yes, I would definitely be responsible for the adult disabled child. Just, unfortunately, I can't imagine who else would be responsible for them.
And you're saying that there's something called a special needs trust.
Yes. Which
okay.
protects their assets in case something happens to you, so that they can still be taken care of by you or your assets. And, you know, they can also potentially get Social Security disability. And you just need a special needs will. I mean, special needs trust from an attorney.
Okay. All right.
It's not really my area of expertise, so I don't want to tell anybody something that's wrong, but I know that people who do have adult children who are living with them, they do get benefits from the government.
Okay.
And they just have to keep them protected.
Okay, gotcha. Well, that's I think an important piece of information just on its own. We've been talking a little bit about your son and the choices that you and your husband gave him and the decisions that he made. What age would you start actually talking to a child about saving and finances? You've said you thought that children should be financially literate, certainly at college, but would you start it any sooner than college?
Yeah, I would.
You would? Okay.
Great, great question. So I came into Matt's life when he was 15, which was a very good age for me to start teaching him to be financially literate. Now, if I was sooner, I would have done it sooner, but Matt started at age 15.
Okay.
My nieces and nephews, I was telling you about with my sister, they are ranging between the ages of 7 and 12, and I teach them every single time I'm with them. As a matter of fact, I kid them, but you know, they were like, every time they come see me, they're like, can we please not talk about money today? We can't stand it.
From 7 to 12.
I actually drive them a little crazy. But
it sounds like it.
Always, like when we go out, for example, every time I take them out, let's say for dinner or something, I tell them, you know, they want a Coke, which is, you know, $2 or whatever, which is bad for them, and it's $2. So then I tell them, I'll pay you $1 if you drink the water that they give you. So that's like one of my money lessons I give them all the time.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I just want to explore that a little bit more, because I know there are people listening who are saying 7 years old. Wow, that sounds kind of young. So I'm going to want to talk about that a little bit more and bring up the age-old question of allowance in children and financial planning. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer having a conversation with Carrie Carbonaro, the author of The Money Queen's Guide for Women Who Want to Build Wealth and Banish Fear. We'll be right back. Carrie, talk to us a little bit more about this 7-year-old you're teaching financial literacy to. Is there any age that's too young? Or is, as long as the child can understand what you're saying, is that when you start? Do you start at 3 or 4?
Yeah, I would say 5. 5 is probably a good age, because you supposedly you don't remember anything before 5 anyway.
Okay.
So I would say 5 is a good age. And if you think about it, you know, when you're, they start to learn math. And money is part of every single day of their life.
That's true.
So, you know, and certainly at age 5, or maybe even before then, they're starting to ask for things. So, you know, one of the things I do, which also drives them crazy, is, you know, let's say they want an Xbox game, you know, for $100. And I'll say, if you made the minimum wage, how many hours do you have to work to get that Xbox game? And I make them do the math.
Okay.
And they hate it, but they do it. And, you know, and then I make it like a contest out of it. You know, who can come up with the number first? And, you know, I've got one of my nephews who's really smart in math, so he always wins. but anyway, it's really cute. And I think they need to learn the value of a dollar as soon as possible. And also what things cost, and getting things on sale, and, you know, why I'm not going to, you know, spend the money on something if I can get it for 50% off. And I want them to be involved in those decisions.
So, again, the child who's at the point that the child is learning about money and asking for things is a good time to begin to teach the child about money.
I think so, in my opinion. Now, granted, I'm not a full-time mom, part-time mom with a stepson who's grown, and then I'm a great aunt. So that's about it. So I know it's not a day in and day out, so it's a little bit, you know, more coming from not somebody who has a child 24/7. So it's a little bit different. But I also am talking about money all the time, every day, with everyone. So I'm also skewed in that sense, too, is no, money's not a taboo to me in our house.
Gotcha.
We talk about it every day.
Now, children, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about, children who ask for allowance, and should parents give them allowance? Is allowance something that should be earned? Is that a great opportunity for learning money management skills, or do you steer clear of allowance conversations?
I actually am a big fan of allowance.
Okay.
I think it should be tied to jobs in the house, or, you know, folding towels, and, you know, making your bed, or doing whatever needs to be done in the house, little tiny things that build responsibility that somebody has to do anyway. So, and then giving them a little bit of money each week, because then they can decide what they want to do with it, and they can start to learn how to budget. They can save, they can spend, they can figure out what things cost. So putting the money and giving the money to them, I think, is a great first step. I'm a big fan of it.
So, and, you know, as you're talking about it, it kind of sounds like it ought to be considered one of those daily living skills. You teach your kids how to brush their teeth and comb their hair, and it's very reasonable to teach them how to think about money as well.
That's what I think. It's, unfortunately, though, we are not financially literate as a country or a nation. So I guess it's not really a daily skill that's taught, even though it should be.
Yeah. Let me ask you about Social Security. There are people, and I think this is more true for women than men, but you tell me, who rely on Social Security as perhaps their only source of income upon retirement. What's your thought about relying on Social Security, and do you think that it's more of something that women do versus men?
Well, first of all, you shouldn't do it. It was never designed to take place as 100% of your retirement income.
Okay.
It was always designed to be what they call the three or four-legged stool, you know, with, you know, a pension, your own savings, the Social Security, and then, you know, something else, like maybe a 401k or something else that you have to work. So it's supposed to be a combination.
Okay.
Social Security is never supposed to be the 100% relier. And actually, as you can see, I think the maximum Social Security, which means you have to have made, you know, six figures. If you made six figures, the most you're ever going to get is, I think, around 29, 30. I don't even think it's up to 30, but with inflation. But so that's the maximum, and that means you had to have made a lot of money, which means most people don't get the top.
Right.
So, and is it worse for women than men? I think that women do rely on Social Security often. However, they get so much less than men because they don't work as long, and they come out of work when they're having children or they're caregiving for parents, so they don't have the longevity. They don't make as much because of the wage gap. So you've got so many strikes against them, and then they take it, you know, potentially early, although men take it early too. So I haven't seen a statistic on that, if women take it more earlier than men. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But I think that women don't know their numbers. So that's the other problem. And not saying that men do, but more men know their numbers than women on what they need to retire.
Okay, when you say know your numbers, what does that, because you talk about that in your book, and you want women to know their net worth and how they're doing, but what does that actually mean, and how do you figure out what your particular numbers are?
Okay, so the first number I always tell people to know is their budget. So what's coming in each month, what's going out each month, and what's left over, if anything.
Okay.
So that's like basic financial planning 101, and so many people don't know it, and more women than men don't. So that's number one. Number two, my second set of numbers are your net worth, which is your assets, everything that you have, your house, your bank accounts, your 401k, anything that you own, minus your liabilities, which is anything that you owe, mortgage, credit cards, student loans. Hopefully you don't have credit card debt and you're paying it off each month, but auto loans equals, so you take your assets minus your liabilities, what you owe, what you own minus what you owe equals your net worth. And that should be growing every single year.
That should be growing.
Growing.
And I
every
heard you say
year you should be saving and paying down debt.
And I heard you say that hopefully folks aren't carrying credit card debt. Is that realistic in today's economy for folks not to be carrying any kind of credit card debt?
If you're doing a budget and you know what's coming in and what's going out, then you should not. That's step one. If you have credit card debt, it means you're overspending. So you're overspending for whatever reason, because you don't know what's coming in and what's going out, or you're just overspending. You're living above your means. So either way, it needs to be looked at, because I don't think anybody should have credit card debt. Now, I think that there's, you know, issues where, you know, somebody loses a job and they, you know, they need to use credit cards to stopgap their life, or, you know, you get into an accident and you have medical bills and hospital bills and things like that. That's a temporary situation where you can turn around and say, okay, let's say I have X amount of dollars left a month at the end of the month left over. I'm going to take that whole entire chunk and pay down those credit cards. So you can like have a plan to pay them off. But if you're constantly doing it because you live your life above your means, I always think to myself, I think what are people waiting for? Are they waiting to win the lottery? Are they waiting to get an inheritance? How do they think this is going to get paid off?
Gotcha. Speaking of things being paid off, there are some folks who find themselves, as a result of significant medical expenses, actually turning to bankruptcy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, and I would tell somebody that I would advise them to see a bankruptcy attorney. So I can't really say much about it, except that in some cases, it's a potential solution.
Okay.
And also, every state is different, and also the federal laws changed recently within the past couple of years to make it a little bit more difficult. So, you know, if I've had family members who have filed bankruptcy. So, I mean, but again, before it was as restrictive as it is now. It's a little bit harder now,
mm-hmm.
but if that's an option, it's an option.
And so do the research before you actually elect.
Well,
to...
no, definitely go talk to an attorney.
Yeah.
You can't do it by yourself anyway.
Right.
But I would definitely seek legal counsel for that.
Now, in your book, you've got some interesting chapter titles, and one of them, which we hear a lot in a lot of different arenas, if you fail to plan, then you plan to fail. But you're attaching it to your financial well-being. If you don't have a financial plan, you're saying, then you're planning to fail.
Well, put it this way. So now you have to remember, I'm a certified financial planner. So financial planning is literally my day job. Like, that is what I do for a living. I plan people's futures with a physical plan. So I think to myself, when somebody's going for a wedding and they're planning a wedding, people spend so much time and energy on planning a wedding or planning a vacation. People love planning really fun stuff, but people don't like planning their financial future, which to me, I can't wrap my head around it, because it's so important. No matter who you are, you should be planning your financial future. And a man is not a plan, and Social Security is not a financial plan.
Okay.
So to me, everybody needs planning.
Gotcha. Now, there are folks who think that financial planning, hiring a financial planner, that's just for the wealthy, and who's got the money to pay a financial planner anyway?
You know, it's so interesting, because that is the perception in the world. I hope over time that will be changing. I know that there's a couple of companies that are now offering financial planning services to their employees. So, for example, I work for one of my the counties that I work for in Florida. They hire me to do financial education and planning for their employees.
Huh.
So I manage their retirement plan, but I'm mainly hired for the education part, where I sit one-on-one with their employees.
So,
and this is regular people, you know, living paycheck to paycheck.
So, and I'm glad you make that point, because again, there are so many things that people will assume is outside of their potential arena, and what you're clearly saying is, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you too are somebody, and maybe particularly you are somebody who needs to have a financial plan.
Well, and it's also because I think if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you know, you might not be getting, you know, great advice in, you know, the area of, let's say, a mortgage. So let's say a mortgage, which is, you know, one of your bigger purchases, you know, let's say you don't even understand the financing, or, you know, you're in something, you know, you're in a negative amortization loan, where, you know, your payment keeps going up over time because you're in a bad mortgage. So you're never going to be able to pay down debt because you're in a mortgage that's ballooning every year.
Right.
So, for example, like, that's just one example. But so somebody like that should not be in that. And I can say to them, no, we're going to, you know, do a loan modification, and we're going to contact the bank, and we're going to see what we can do. And, you know, I do a lot of different things when I work one-on-one with my county clients, than I do in my regular day-to-day practice. But everybody still needs help.
Gotcha.
It's just a matter of which type of help they need.
Now, you know, I notice, and I'm sure we've all seen these ads for reverse mortgages, and a lot of times it's the woman who is touting the wonderful value of a reverse mortgage in her life. She's living alone, but now she can live this wonderful life because she's gotten a reverse mortgage. I know you're not a mortgage person, but I'm just wondering what it seems to me that many of those companies are actually targeting older women. What's your thought, and what do you want people to be aware of?
So, well, first of all, the good news is that they're highly regulated now. For a long time that they weren't, and there was a little bit of abuse in the industry, it's much better now. Secondly, I think that they're targeting the older women because women live so much longer and they outlive their spouses. So then the woman's in the house alone,
uh-huh.
and, you know, bills do potentially pile up. Now, a reverse mortgage would work for somebody if they want to stay in the home no matter what, and they don't want to leave the home or the asset of the home to their heirs, and they want to take money out of, you know, pull money out of the house now. So the way a reverse mortgage works, you either get a lump sum or you get a monthly payment from, so it's almost like the bank's almost like buying your house now, but you get to stay there, and then you're either getting paid monthly or paid a lump sum. So for some people it works, but again, then it's not an asset of yours that you get to give and pass to the kids.
Gotcha. So there's a lot to think about. In all of this, there's a lot to think about.
Exactly.
And I also notice in your book, you offer some additional websites that can be useful to your readers. One is called irelaunch.com.
And, yes, that's for somebody who's going back in the workforce.
Okay, so that's irelaunch.com. And then I also saw one, retirementjobs.com.
Yes.
So there are lots of resources that you make available, and certainly the book is an easy read. And I think it's important that it is an easy read, because as you and I have been talking about this hour, so many people just sort of zone out when you talk to them about the potential of talking about money and money management.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. So I tried to, that's why I started the book with my story, to try to make it like an interesting hook where all the women, everybody loves the story. Every woman reads that story and is like, give me more, give me more. And then the next thing you know, I'm talking about financial planning.
Right.
So they're like, I sort of like lull them in, and then I'm teaching them. So, and also another thing too, because I find a lot of women just do not have the time to read. The book is also on audio via Audible.
Okay.
And I've had a couple of my people contact me and say, you know, I listen to it in my car. I listen to it, you know, in the gym, on the treadmill. And, you know, that works great for women.
I would think so. Women are so used to multitasking that I would think that would be a real plus. Carrie Carbonaro, thank you so much for spending time with us today and for talking with us about The Money Queen's Guide for Women Who Want to Build Wealth and Banish Fear. And by the way, men can learn from this as well.
Absolutely.
Again, Carrie, thank you so much. I very much appreciate your time and the information that you've shared with us today and in the book.
Wonderful. Well, it was so great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
And
I will definitely reach out to you when I'm in D.C. You know what? I got to get your I followed you on Twitter, but I don't think I have your email or LinkedIn. Are you on LinkedIn, too?
I am.
Okay. I'll find you on LinkedIn, because then that will have your email on there.
Terrific.
Okay, wonderful.
All righty. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Okay, bye.
Take care. Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. It's 301-654-5286. And folks, if you would like to listen to this program or any other Mind Talk program, you can always do so on demand at myndtalk.org. You can send email, question, or comments to myndtalk@aol.com. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.